Ready to explore the expansive universe of aviation and cutting-edge space technology in Turtle Bay's newest exhibition, Mission Aerospace, presented by Dr. Eric and Tiffany Blassingame and produced by Minotaur Mazes, on display at Turtle Bay Museum January 18th through April 20th. This highly interactive maze puzzle is sure to inspire all generations. Mission Aerospace at Turtle Bay Museum is free for members and included with paid admission. Learn more at turtlebay.org.
Join Aaron and Bill for We the People Radio, Sundays, noon until 2.
It's conservative talk radio with a liberal dose of humor. Get the whole story from experts around the world delivering facts rather than opinion.
Missed a show? Busy at noon? No problem. Listen to our free archives when you have time. No commercial interruptions or download restrictions. We the People Radio.
.us.
Gold Leaf Nursery is celebrating 50 years in business. Yep, 50 years. Seems like yesterday our nursery and landscape business was just a little seedling itself, but the truth is, we've been serving Shasta County for 50 years, growing shrubs, trees, and veggie plants since 1975. Also, as a licensed contractor, we've landscaped shopping centers, city parks, and custom residential homes. The sale will start now and continue through springtime. All 1 gallon and larger shrubs and trees are on sale. With spring right around the corner, we have a good selection of spring shade bloomers, such as azaleas and camellias, and many other sun blooming plants to enhance your landscape in those sunny locations in the yard. This is a perfect time of the year to start preparing your vegetable garden. We have organic soils and fertilizers, including a full line of John and Bob's Organics, and we carry non-GMO seeds. So rest assured, you can have a healthy planting crop in your vegetable garden. If you have not been to Gold Leaf Nursery, we invite you to check us out and see for yourself why we have so many customers tell us what a unique nursery we have. Gold Leaf Nursery, 6186 Churn Creek Road, across from Tucker Oaks Golf Course and 1/4 mile from Airport Road.
Now is a great time to prepare for the upcoming wildfire season. REU and city staff are busy clearing vegetation to mitigate wildfire risk to our power lines, facilities, and the community. You can also prepare by trimming back shrubs and tree branches that are closer than 5 feet from your home. Clear debris from your roof and gutter and clear dead vegetation on your property. For information about tree trimming and proximity to power lines, call 530-224-4356. Please remember, we all need to work together to prevent wildfires in our community.
Looking for the freshest top-shelf flower? Look no further than the Queen of Dragons in the city of Shasta Lake, where they work directly with small, local farmers to bring you the finest flower that fits your price. The Queen of Dragons has the best prices on carts, edibles, concentrates, and pre-rolls. Plus, don't miss happy hour every day from 6 p.m. until close and all day Sundays. Don't just stock up on toilet paper. Queen of Dragons has great deals, so you can stock up on the best flower for the best prices. So what are you waiting for? Stop by Queen of Dragons at 5044 Shasta Dam Boulevard or call 530-238-5638 for details or delivery. That's 530-238-5638. And don't forget to follow Queen of Dragons on Facebook and X at the Queen Dragons for all the latest deals and updates. Support Queen of Dragons, a local business in the city of Shasta Lake, where you will find the most friendly and knowledgeable staff. Queen of Dragons at 5044 Shasta Dam Boulevard. Visit queenofdragons.com or follow us on X at the Queen Dragons.
Hi, I'm Tamara Wood, presiding judge of the Shasta County Superior Court. The Superior Court is currently accepting applications from individuals interested in serving on the Shasta County Grand Jury. To apply or to obtain further information, please visit ShastaCountyGrandJury.org.
The Grand Jury is one of the most important and interesting volunteer opportunities you can be part of. Applications are now being accepted. To apply or get more details, visit ShastaCountyGrandJury.org.
Be part of the solution. Apply today.
Bye. Join me for the first Thursday of every month at 6 p.m. for my show, North State Now. In this one-hour show, we cover what's happening in the music scene, theater, food, and arts. We get in-depth interviews with local business owners, musicians, actors, and authors. Listen in, tune in, call in, participate. Win tickets to concerts and theater productions. It's a lot of fun, and believe me, it keeps us going. Join me, your host, Linda Bott, for North State Now, the first Thursday, right here on KCNR 96.5 FM and 1460 AM, also streaming at KCNR1460.com.
Thank you. why are we bombing these defenseless civilians? Dresden is an interesting story. It was requested by the Soviets because they thought that there was a massive German transportation and war material being amassed there to be sent to the front. And they had requested the RAF or the Americans, whichever job it was, whichever sector that was, to take out Dresden. And bombing wasn't quite as accurate in those days as it was in ours. And terrible devastation was wrought. And that's when Churchill, you know, watching the scenes of horror that he saw, began seriously to question it. And that's to his favor, I think.
Yeah. One that has been especially prevalent here in the past year or so, I think there was a Washington Post op-ed a while back that said, essentially, Winston Churchill allowed 3 million people in India to die of starvation.
Mm-hmm. There's a reply on our Truth and Heresy section to that specific op-ed written by Soren Geiger, who is the director of research for the Churchill Project. And it's very good. I recommend it. As we were compiling the Churchill documents, the document volumes that accompany the official biography, we found instance after instance of Churchill and the War Cabinet trying to figure out how to get grain to relieve the famine in India. They tried everywhere. They tried Australia. Canada offered, but the Canadian shipping was all directed to the war effort, and it wasn't practical to get the grain from Canada. Australia offered and did deliver, ultimately, 350,000 tons. Churchill at one point wrote to Roosevelt and said, "Dear Mr. President, I'm terribly concerned. We have an awful problem with this famine in India. Can you help?" Roosevelt said, "No, we have a war to fight." And it's all in the documents. So the stuff has to be taken in context. And we've refuted time and again, as does Andrew Roberts in his new Churchill biography, that without Churchill, as Arthur Herman, the biographer, said, the Bengal famine would have been worse.
Richard Langworth with us, senior fellow at Hillsdale College with the Churchill Project. Again, you can find more on some of these at winstonchurchill.hillsdale.edu on the Truths and Heresies tab. Winston Churchill suffered from manic depression and was an alcoholic.
Oh, dear, yeah. The British writer C.P. Snow said, you know, Winston wasn't an alcoholic. No alcoholic could drink that much. And he had a point, because Churchill had an iron constitution. He drank a very great deal, but it never seemed to affect him. And no one in his family or any of his colleagues ever saw him the worse for drink, except once. At Tehran, when a bodyguard told me that he said I accompanied him home with Eden after a late night drinking bout with the Russians, drinking these little glasses of frosted vodka, and they were both tottering. They were still coherent, but they definitely needed help to get back to the embassy. But Churchill had this tremendous capacity for alcohol, and he used it as a prop. He would exaggerate his intake of alcohol. He often said to his friend Professor Lindemann, his scientific advisor, they'd be sitting in a restaurant, and Churchill would say, "Prof, pray calculate the amount of brandy, whiskey, and spirits I've consumed in my life, and tell me how high it would reach in this room." And Professor Lindemann would take out his slide rule. He was an act, of course. It was just a joke. He pretended to do a few calculations, and he'd say, "I'm sorry, Winston, it'd only reach up to our ankles." And Churchill would say, "How much to do, how little time remains." So it was greatly exaggerated. Undoubtedly, he drank a lot more than you and I.
Sure.
But he had a constitution that could somehow take it. And his secret was he drank mostly at mealtime. And meals were long.
Sure. This one I mentioned to you off the air. Said, man, it goes back a number of years. A golden oldie, as you put it. Winston Churchill knew about Pearl Harbor, the pending attack, and did not alert the United States.
Yeah, years ago we published a piece by a former CIA agent who had reviewed all of the relevant documents, including some secret documents, so he couldn't talk about those. Yeah, a Dutch freighter was supposed to have seen the Japanese fleet steaming for Pearl Harbor. How did the freighter knew or figured out that where the fleet was headed is a mystery. There was also the winds code in a Japanese weather forecast that was supposedly heard in Annapolis, but not heard in Honolulu. Think about it just for a minute from the standpoint of Churchill's point of view. Suppose he did know. What would he have gained by not telling Roosevelt to get the United States into war? Certainly the United States would have been in the war at that point. He would have told Roosevelt. Roosevelt would have summoned the fleet, sent the word to Pearl Harbor, sent the destroyers and cruisers out and battleships, and had them at sea. Planes in the air. And what would have happened then? Well, Roosevelt would have been grateful, and that would have got the United States in the war by itself. So there's no reason to think that, as Warren Kimball, the Roosevelt Churchill historian, said, to suppose that Churchill and Roosevelt, or Roosevelt, who's also accused of knowing in advance, so to suppose that they knew in advance and didn't do anything would suggest that they're stupid, and no one has ever thought either one of them were stupid.
You can find, again, more of these myths under the Truths and Heresies tab at winstonchurchill.hillsdale.edu, winstonchurchill.hillsdale.edu. Richard, thank you so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Thank you, Scott.
That's our previous interview with Richard Langworth, who passed away last week at the age of 83 years old. Up next, Catherine Austin Fitz joins us. We'll talk about the danger of central bank digital currencies. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
You're listening to What's in a Name. Though this particular Michigan city's name at first look has a fairly simple origin story, it's a bit more complicated than it first seems. The name Detroit comes from a French word that means straight, like a body of water, which, in turn, comes from the city's positioning around the Detroit River. The river comes from Lake Erie, one of the five Great Lakes. The city still remains as one of the oldest and most important cities in the Midwest. So the name comes from French settlements in the early 18th century, which was roughly 300 years ago. The land itself has been populated for over 11,000 years by many different peoples, including the Iroquois and the Hurons. Rich in resources, it was highly contested, and after many battles, ultimately ended up within the United States, first as a territory and then as part of the state of Michigan. It has since earned the nickname of the Motor City due to its history with Henry Ford. This has been What's in a Name. My name is Megan Pidcock, and you're listening to Radio Free Hillsdale 101.7 FM. Court is in session with Letter of the Law on Radio Free Hillsdale 101.7 FM. Despite how long clotheslines have been in existence, which is about how long laundry has, they actually can be quite controversial. If you have ever lived in a condominium complex, an area with an HOA, or a general closed community with its own set of rules, then you may have encountered a ban on clotheslines. However, Vermont has decided to take a stance against any rules outlawing air drying your clothing outside by banning the banning of clotheslines. As of May 27, 2009, according to the Vermont statutes, no municipalities or other associations may ban clotheslines, solar panels, or other renewable energy sources. The state and other states with similar laws are considered right-to-dry states, where its residents are guaranteed to be able to hang their clothes out to dry, as well as participate in other energy-conserving activities. Florida was the first to pass such a law in the 1970s, with other states gradually following. There are currently 19 states with similar laws. Push for these bans comes from a want to be more environmentally friendly, including air-drying clothes instead of relying on a dryer. However, local community guidelines may outlaw this, as some may consider it ugly or not aesthetically pleasing. These laws are often put in place after a lawsuit between an individual and the complex they live in regarding this issue, and then eventually becomes the precedent within the state for the universal allowance of clotheslines. So, if you happen to be hanging your clothes out to dry in Vermont and someone gives you trouble, know that you won't be airing dirty laundry by standing up to them. This has been Megan Pidcock on Letter of the Law. If you want to hear more of Letter of the Law or other student shows like this, go to RadioFreeHillsdale.com. Once again, you're listening to Radio Free Hillsdale 101.7 FM.
Welcome to the Grammar Minute, where we're saving the English language 60 seconds at a time. I'm Lauren Smith, and I'm here to talk about ChatGPT. I'm a writer of both news and fiction by trade, so I'm in one of the jobs people think ChatGPT could eliminate. So, am I worried? The answer is no, and the reason is that grammar isn't everything. I know that's a weird thing for me to say, but it's true. Good grammar alone doesn't make for good writing, and even though ChatGPT has generally correct grammar and constructs pieces that wouldn't get too many marks in red pen, it's still currently unable to generate anything resembling written art. So, here's the question. How can writers stay ahead of ChatGPT? The answer is, write like a human. Be expressive. Use good grammar, of course, but also go beyond the grammar into style and tone and voice. Learn to be yourself in your writing and cultivate yourself into the kind of writer people will want to read. That's your Grammar Minute.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertrand. Be sure to check out the Hillsdale College Podcast Network. You can find all of our audio at podcast.hillsdale.edu. That includes older episodes of this program, plus other great Hillsdale College audio like In Primus, The Larry Arn Show, Liberty and Learning with Mark Levin and Larry Arn, and the Hillsdale College Online Courses Podcast. All of it at podcast.hillsdale.edu or wherever you get your audio, from Spotify, from Apple Podcasts, from Amazon, or elsewhere. Look for the Hillsdale College Podcast Network. We're joined now by Catherine Austin Fitz from Solari Incorporated, talking about the danger of central bank digital currencies. Catherine was on campus as part of our CCA lecture series on economic issues and controversies. You can find her full lecture at freedomlibrary.hillsdale.edu. Catherine, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Scott. What a treat to be at Hillsdale. This is my first visit, and it's just beautiful.
Thank you for being here. Thank you for the kind words about the campus. As we talk about your subject today, digital currencies, we probably start with a definition. What are digital currencies? Why are we talking about them?
We're talking about them because a plan is underway by the central bankers, led by the Bank of International Settlements, with a big partnership by the Federal Reserve to institute central bank digital currencies. So they're called currencies, but they're really not. They're a fundamental conversion of the currency system as we know it to an all-digital system that gives the central bankers complete control, including the ability to make very specific and complex rules about where and how we can use our money. So it's really a control grid. And I should say there are many different ways of doing a CBDC that are being prototyped around the world. You can do it through the central banks. You can also do it privately. And interestingly enough, central bankers still have legal obligations to the people's representatives. So in all, what we're trying to avoid here is an all-digital monetary system that allows central control through complex rule systems through the hardware and software, which is why I keep telling everybody, make cash great again.
What would it take to get to that point? We talk about digital currencies, and perhaps people in their mind have either an idea about cryptocurrency or maybe just think about, you know, Venmo. We're transferring monies here and there.
Right.
What's the difference with a CBDC, a central bank digital currency, or the kind of currency you're talking about?
So the big difference is if you consolidate all financial transactions, number one, into digital. So there's no non-digital alternatives. And if you consolidate them in a way where no matter whether it's a credit card, a banking transaction, or a new kind of currency issued by the central banks, is it done in a wire transfer and surveillance system that will allow them centrally to make complex rules and use AI and software to enforce it? It's interesting. One of the things you'll read when you look at the news is people saying AI is exploding the energy use. Mm-hmm. You know, we're unmothballing nuclear plants
right.
because we need so much energy. And yet, if you listen to the investment analysts, they'll say, why is so much money being poured in? Because nobody's found the killer app. There's only about 5% of the uses of AI that have been financially or economically productive. That's because control is the killer app. And part of the control is transaction control of our financial transactions.
What is it about digital currencies and this financial system you describe that is such a threat to our freedom, such a threat to our liberty?
So there are two things. So I want to stress again, I don't think we have a financial problem. I think we have a governance problem. And it's interesting because at Hillsdale you'll see a lot of focus on politics and political philosophy and how to govern and leadership. And it's because you understand it's a political problem. And so we have a secret governance system. It's non-transparent. It is it's operating significantly outside the laws of the Constitution and the financial management laws of the United States. And if you look at the noncompliance with financial management laws, I would say since 1998, literally the federal government has been run as a financial criminal enterprise. And so we have a governance problem. And you cannot solve a governance problem with a financial product. Okay. So the question is, why are private or digital currencies so dangerous? Because in a world of innovative with a great, wonderful governance system, they would be wonderful. They would, you know, they would create far more. I'm a big fan of both private currencies and local currencies. We could have far more optimization. We could have far more creativity. We could have far more innovation. It would be wonderful. However, when you put those tools in the hands of a secret governance system that especially can take enormous amounts of financial transactions and have dark, I mean, if you look at the history of dark money in the United States, the corruption is really an explosion of secret money. And so when you give these kinds of tools and powers to a secret governance system, you have a financial coup. So let's look at what the financial coup looks like. Since 1913, in the United States, we've had a balance of power between the bankers who run monetary policy and the people's representatives who run fiscal policy. The Congress decides how taxes are going to work, how taxes are going to be spent, the money we're going to borrow from our pension funds. And then once they make the rules, those are implemented by an executive branch. We are now talking about an integration of digital technology throughout the economy that when you combine it with a digital ID system and an all-digital monetary system, bam, it all locks together to create what I call a digital concentration camp. And what that means is that it gives the central bankers the ability to literally set the rules for fiscal policy and implement them without the Congress, without the executive branch. It's literally a coup d'etat with the bankers at a highly central level taking control of the entire fiscal policy line of government.
Catherine Austin Fitz with us, president of Solari, Inc., talking about the danger of digital currencies. China has a digital currency, a surveillance coin, it's called the social credit system. Tell us about the way that China has used its financial system in a way that perhaps we should be worried about.
Right. So we're looking at the ability to track people's behavior and incentivize good and bad. You know, if you don't behave, you're going to have to eat synthetically made lab, you know, meat grown in the lab, et cetera, but also spatial control. So you see zones created. We've read about the 15-minute smart cities. You're creating zones where literally, whether it's tracking you through surveillance or where your money works, you can constrain somebody to a particular physical space. So you're talking about, you know, not only how you can use your time and allocate your resources, but where and how you go. So let's go back to the pandemic. If I don't want you going further a mile from your house, forget what your governor or your state legislator says. The federal government, you know, the central bankers at a central location, if you leave, you know, if you go further than a mile from your house, you know, their satellites will be surveilling. They can turn off your money. So if they want you to take a vaccine every week or every month, if you don't, you know, that is condition precedent to getting, you know, your money kept turned on.
That's Catherine Austin Fitz from Solari Incorporated. We'll return in just a moment to talk more about the danger of central bank digital currencies. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
I'm Joshua Palladino, a PhD candidate at Hillsdale College. Here's master's student Nathan Naveau with a message from George Washington.
George Washington, in his farewell address, said, "Of all the dispositions and habits which lead to political prosperity, religion and morality are indispensable supports. In vain would the man claim the tribute of patriotism who should labor to subvert these great pillars of human happiness, these firmest props of the duties of men and citizens. The mere politician, equally with the pious man, ought to respect and to cherish them. A volume could not trace all their connections with private and public felicity."
Hillsdale College, pursuing truth, defending liberty since 1844.
Hi. Hi, I'm Sarah, a student at Hillsdale College. Here is President of Hillsdale College, Dr. Larry Arn, on the three branches of government.
There's a lot of confusion these days about the relationship of the three branches of government, especially among many who are in government. Some think the judiciary sits atop the other two branches, the legislative and the executive. Others think the president sits above Congress and the courts. In fact, all three branches are equally accountable to the Constitution and therefore to the people who made the Constitution. The President, members of Congress, and federal judges all take an oath to the Constitution. In making the laws, Congress must adhere to the Constitution. In executing the laws, the President must abide by the Constitution. In interpreting the laws, judges are bound by the Constitution. All the people's representatives are accountable to the Constitution, and therein lies our liberty.
This Constitution Minute was brought to you by Hillsdale College. To receive a free pocket constitution and declaration, go to constitutionminute.com.
Hey, it's Scott Bertram, and I want to tell you about something new from Hillsdale College. It's the Hillsdale College Podcast Network. Check it out right now. Go to podcast.hillsdale.edu. The Hillsdale College Podcast Network offers free nationwide access to all of Hillsdale's podcast content. That means shows like the Hillsdale Dialogues, the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour, the Hillsdale College K-12 Classical Education Podcast, the Larry P. Arn Show, and now, new, the Imprimis Podcast. You can listen wherever you are and whenever you want, and it's always free. You can subscribe to any program with new episodes delivered right to your device. If you want to come close to stepping inside a Hillsdale College classroom, well, the Hillsdale College Podcast Network is for you. Get informed and get entertained at podcast.hillsdale.edu. That's podcast.hillsdale.edu.
Welcome to the Grammar Minute, where we're saving the English language 60 seconds at a time. I'm Lauren Smith, and today we're going to talk about using foreign words in your writing. Before you say, I only speak English, think twice about that. There are probably quite a few foreign words you use all the time without really thinking about it. How about versus, etc., ad nauseum, en masse, status quo? I'm not here to tell you these words and phrases shouldn't be used. They have widely accepted English meanings that pose no difficulty for most readers. But look how different these words look from most of the words we use in common language. Faux pas doesn't look English when you find it in the middle of a sentence. These phrases can often be unclear, removed from their original meanings, and no more descriptive than plain English. So, in general, avoid using foreign words and phrases in your writing if there is an easy English equivalent. That's your Grammar Minute. Visit thegrammarminute.com for more tips and tricks.
We're back on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. We are talking with Catherine Austin Fitz from Solari Incorporated about the danger of central bank digital currencies. And Catherine, we finished the last segment by talking about the ability of governments to perhaps allow or disallow access to funds based on whether or not you follow some sort of directive. And it reminds me, we just think back to maybe 4 years ago in the middle of COVID, and there were these discussions. And with a digital currency, as you say, things get locked in, it becomes far more possible to say you can't travel if we don't want you to, you can't leave this area, you can't spend your money here, you can't go shopping here.
But let's look at the Constitution. Under the Constitution, the powers not delegated to the federal government by the states are reserved to the states. What we're talking about is the central bankers using a digital monetary system to usurp all state powers. So they're making rules with relation to healthcare when that is reserved. Healthcare is the power reserved to the states, but they're dictating it and they can enforce it through the money. So we're looking at not just a coup of the federal Congress, you know, people's representatives and executive branch, but the state as well. This is how you shred the Constitution.
Why is this, as you put it, financial transaction freedom so important?
Because what we need for freedom is we need the ability to gather, to speak freely, and to exercise our ability to own property and develop that property in ways with each other that create prosperity. All prosperity, in my experience, comes from building healthy, you know, healthy children, who get a great education, I'm back to Hillsdale, and then go out and build family enterprises. That's the basis of most fortunes in America. And that can't happen if you're not allowed to own property and if it's 2030 and you have no assets, because they've used their transaction control to take all of your assets. So if you look at all the ways that what I call plunder capitalism or land grabs are engineered in this country, the mechanism by which your assets, you will be stripped or drained of your assets, because inflation, in fact, is a method of draining. They can be taken or they can be drained. But all of that comes with the ability of a central power to say, unless you do what I say, I'm going to stop all your transactions. I mean, if my business couldn't wire money back and forth tomorrow, I, the question is, okay, I'm sunk. So I've been in litigation with the federal government where people tried to stop my transaction. I know what that feels like. So literally money flows on train tracks. You know, whether it's the Fed wire or the SWIFT system, we have all these train tracks, hardware and software by which money runs. And if you can centrally control those switching systems, you know, so I'll give you an example. If you ask anyone, does the Fed control the euro market? They'll say, no, they're not in control of the euro market. If you ask anybody who works in the back office in Europe, do the Fed control the euro dollar market? They say, technically, no. But if a Parisian bank should do something the Fed doesn't like, they'll hiccup their dollar transactions and they'll have to do what they say in the euro dollar market. Hmm. That's the transaction control. So let me get back. We all know who the Canadian truckers were,
mm-hmm.
right? That's transaction control.
Yeah. What's the mechanism to click this into place? What should we be watching for? What are the moves that we should be aware of?
So if you look at online financial payments and censorship, it shows you how the mechanism is clicking into place to implement that. If you look at the merchant codes on the credit cards and stopping gun purchases, you see it clicking together on credit cards. If you look at the debanking, we just passed a bill in Tennessee to not permit banks with over $100 billion to debank someone for religious or political reasons. All of those are taking, and of course the Canadian truckers are such a great example, but all of those are examples of, in all the different financial transaction lines, asserting more and more control. We also see the Fed implementing fast payment systems.
Mm-hmm.
At the heart of a healthy tax base of family wealth are as many small banks and farms as possible. You want, and small business. And you want to have a very healthy, diversified banking system. The Fed is doing many things, and the federal government is doing many things to consolidate the banking system that shrinks wealth, that shrinks the tax base, but it improves central control. And during the pandemic, the idea of injecting $5 trillion, mostly going to Wall Street, and then shutting down Main Street is a perfect example of consolidation. Okay, so now the Fed is rolling out a fast payment system, and if you go to the World Bank, you'll see they are overseeing the rollouts of fast payment systems all over the world. The three banks that went down, and I would say got run, so I don't think the banks failed so much as they got run, were all three prototypes on the fast payment system. In my opinion, the fast payment system, which right now is voluntary, but the day could come when the Fed requires it, would make it much easier for the New York Fed member banks to run the Michigan banking system, mm-hmm. and dramatically consolidate the banks, as they did during the Great Depression.
Catherine Austin Fitz with us, president of Solari, Inc., on the danger of digital currencies. She's lecturing here at Hillsdale's CCA on economic issues and controversies. This road to complete central control, CBDCs, are one way, but you say there are many different ways, many different roads to perhaps get there in the future.
There, you know, we've been digitizing throughout the economy, and today I'm going to show a slide that shows sort of the 12 main steps, but there are two that we should focus on. The first and next one, the most important, is digital ID. If we can put into place a uniform digital ID system globally, and when they market it, they don't, you know, they have 50, it's like Heinz 57 varieties. They got 57 varieties of how to sell you. You know, one's called a vaccine passport, one's called the Gavi system, one's called Real ID. We have a real food fight over Real ID in the United States. But they're all basically digital ID. So the first thing, And one of the things, there's an effort to push digital ID in the heartland by saying, oh, this is how we solve election fraud, or this is how we solve immigration, which is a complete canard, because we had good elections and tight borders before digital technology existed. Okay, so anyway, but so digital ID and then an all-digital monetary system. And there's been a real effort to, particularly during the pandemic, to kill cash. And so if you come to Solari, we've got hats called Make Cash Great Again. Anyway, but interestingly enough, because of the things that have gone on in disasters when the electricity system goes down, there's starting to be a reversal. We just saw the Norwegian Central Bank come out. They're down to 3% cash in Norway. And the Norwegian Central Bank came out and said, you know, given what is happening around the world when electricity goes out, maybe it's not such a good idea to go cashless. We're going to take cash back up. And we saw the same thing in New Zealand. The governor of the Central Bank of New Zealand stood up after the cyclone and said, thank heavens we had cash, because otherwise we would have just been toast. And I remember turning to my co-host and saying, apparently he didn't get the memo, you know. But people are starting to realize that for many, I live in a community where not only do people love cash, but they don't want a bank account. They don't want to, you know, so we go down to the post office and we all see each other every week because we're getting money orders.
Right.
So, you know, there is a percentage of the population who understands, one, the benefit of privacy, thanks to cash. But the other is that understand the benefit of, you know, when you are at the store and you've got to shell out cash, you're more careful.
Yes.
And in a period of strong inflation, you know, it keeps us honest.
Catherine Austin Fitz is president of Solari, Inc. She's here on Hillsdale's campus delivering a lecture, The Danger of Digital Currencies, part of our CCA lecture series on economic issues and controversies. Catherine, thank you so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Oh, well, thank you, and thank you for the opportunity to come to Hillsdale and see your beautiful college and campus.
Up next, we talk with Tori Hope Peterson, a Hillsdale graduate, about her brand new book, Breaking the Patterns That Break You. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
The Old Ball Game, where we talk about the past of America's favorite pastime. I'm Tate Christensen. Today we talk about baseball in the Civil War. Baseball was a favorite pastime of soldiers in both the Union and in the Confederacy, but it was especially popular in the North with the Union officers. Soldiers of both sides used a variety of sports to entertain themselves in their downtime, but baseball was the most popular. Soldiers often talked about baseball in their letters back home, their diaries, and in their newspapers. They would play the most baseball in the winter and the spring months when they were not busy with the war. Soldiers would spend time playing baseball and watching baseball, as armies would host different games playing one another and often drew large crowds. A Christmas Day game in 1862 drew a crowd of 40,000 soldier spectators. During the war, in 1857, the National Association of Baseball Players was formed. It was the first governing body for baseball, and it met annually. This has been the Old Ball Game on Radio Free Hillsdale 101.7 FM.
Hi, I'm Joy, a student at Hillsdale College. Here is President of Hillsdale College, Dr. Larry Arn, on why the Constitution limits government.
James Madison writes in Federalist 51 that men are not angels. Their passions and self-interest often get the better of their reason and sense of justice. So we need government in order to protect our rights against those who would take them away. But for the same reason, Madison writes, government must be limited, because people in government have passions and interests too. Many Americans today forget this. Supposing that we can do away with constitutional limits on government, supposing that the unelected bureaucrats being put in charge of our health care, for example, will rule as if they are angels. If Madison was correct about human nature, this is foolish and dangerous.
This Constitution Minute was brought to you by Hillsdale College. To receive a free pocket constitution and declaration, go to constitutionminute.com.
Hey, it's Scott Bertram, and I want to tell you about something new from Hillsdale College. It's the Hillsdale College Podcast Network. Check it out right now. Go to podcast.hillsdale.edu. The Hillsdale College Podcast Network offers free nationwide access to all of Hillsdale's podcast content. That means shows like the Hillsdale Dialogues, the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour, the Hillsdale College K-12 Classical Education Podcast, the Larry P. Arnn Show. You can listen wherever you are and whenever you want, and it's always free. Find out more about all of our shows at podcast.hillsdale.edu. You can subscribe to any program with new episodes delivered right to your device. If you want to come close to stepping inside a Hillsdale College classroom, well, the Hillsdale College Podcast Network is for you. Get informed and get entertained at podcast.hillsdale.edu. That's podcast.hillsdale.edu. Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. Be sure to follow us on X. We're at Hillsdale Radio for updated show and guest information. We're joined by Tori Hope Peterson. She is an author, speaker, Bible teacher, and much more. She's the author of the new book, Breaking the Patterns That Break You, Healing from the Pain of Your Past and Finding Real Hope That Lasts. She's also a Hillsdale graduate from 2018. You can find more at her website, ToriHopePeterson.com. Tori, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Looking forward to talking a bit about the book. For people who did not read Fostered, your first book, and much of that story can be found in Fostered. It's also alluded to at times in Breaking the Patterns That Break You. This idea about being broken, your story is different than my story, anyone else's story. I'm wondering if you see brokenness as an on-off switch, or are there levels? Are you broken or not, or can you be a little broken or a lot broken?
Yeah, I would say that we all have various levels of brokenness. And I think that we have a tendency to shy away from them. There's a scripture in Isaiah where it's prophesizing who the Messiah is going to be. And it says that, you know, he's a man of much suffering and that people will turn his face away from them. So since the beginning of time, we have had the tendency to turn our face away from our own brokenness and our own suffering and others' brokenness and suffering. And so this book is really an encouragement to notice our own and actually embrace it.
Book is structured with chapters that are lies that have fed the patterns that have left you broken, you say. And I figure in a structure like this, there's a reason that the thing that is first is first. And that lie is that self-love is selfish. So why is that lie first up in this book?
Yes, it is first for a reason, and it is intentional, and I believe that that's because it's a foundational lie that I think a lot of people have to break through to really begin to understand all the other truths in the book. And so, you know, as people of faith, this book is really written for anybody, but especially for people of faith. We are called to be humble. We're told that love is humble. And so as believers, we often want to walk out our lives in humility. But I think that there are many believers, many Christians who get self-hatred confused with humility. And God does not call us to hate ourselves. There is this phrase in the church, often in the evangelical church, more of God, less of me. And that's theologically correct. We can find that in John. But when a lot of people hear that, they think that they need to get rid of themselves, that they need to hate themselves. But really, in Genesis, it says that God looked at everything that he made and he called it good. And so that means that God did a good job making you. God did a good job making me. And we are made in the image of God, which means we can embrace who God has called us to be, can love who God has created us to be. And I think when we begin to embrace those parts of our God-given gifts, our God-given calling, we experience a lot of freedom because ultimately we're looking to God. When we look to God, we become more like him. When we look to God, we want to live out his image. And I think there's so much freedom in understanding that self-hatred. Self-hatred is not humility. God does not call us to hate ourselves. He calls us to love who he's created us to be.
A different chapter, time heals all wounds. That's a lie, and that's something we hear all the time. It's a cliche. Just give it time, everything will be okay. What are the active steps that we need to take to heal those things that are truly bothering us?
Yeah, we often hear that time heals all wounds, and the book is called Breaking the Patterns That Break You, because there's psychological research that shows that if we grow up in dysfunctional homes, we're 4 times more likely to enter into dysfunctional relationships. And I think there are a lot of people who they grow up in dysfunction and they want something different for their own lives, and they set out for that, but they still enter into dysfunction. And the research shows that we do that because it's usually, if we grow up in dysfunction and chaos, we enter into dysfunction and chaos because it's where our brains find comfort, because it's what we've always known, it's just what we're used to. And so what I realized is that these patterns, they function under the surface in the dark. They're very hard to realize and understand and see, because it's what we've always known. It's how we've always functioned. And so the idea of this book is really to bring these patterns to the surface so that we can see them, so that we can acknowledge them, because the reality is time does not heal wounds. What we do with our patterns, what we do with our past, that's what heals wounds. It's what we do with our time that heals.
Tori Hope Peterson with us. Breaking the Patterns That Break You is her new book, Healing from the Pain of Your Past and Finding Real Hope That Lasts. You mentioned early in the book, as you were joining a church, they gave you a test, and you found your spiritual gift is hospitality. And I kept that in mind as I read later in the book this little section that says, saying no is not selfish. That must be very difficult for someone whose spiritual gift is hospitality. How do we know when the right time is to say no, when you're asked to do something, to help with something, to do anything?
Yeah, the Lord has given us discernment, and also we're limited beings. And so to say no and to sometimes set boundaries for ourselves, I believe is actually an act of humility, because the only being that is limitless and that can always say yes, that can always take on all the weight of all the service and all the love is God. He's the only one that's limitless. And when we say no, when we are not trying to fill the gap of everything, God fills the gaps of our inadequacies. And that's done really through an act of humility of saying, you know, I can't do it all. And I think that takes discernment, because the Lord also calls us to welcome people in and calls us to love. And so we have to pray through discernment to understand how to guard our hearts, how to say yes, how to say no, how to welcome people in.
The section inside the chapter, you can't change your story, one of the lies that has led to brokenness. And I read with interest the part about relationships and friends. And it says, well, friendships can be therapeutic, they cannot be therapy. Relationships can be healing, they cannot be our soul healer. And I'm reading this and thinking about the resurgence in popularity of the TV show Friends, which was very popular at the time it ran, and now college students and youngsters are finding it streaming and binging and watching all sorts of episodes. And the message of Friends is that you don't need faith. I mean, yeah, it's a comedy, I understand. But the message that can be taken is you don't need faith, you don't need God, you don't even need family if you have friends. Friends can fix everything if you're surrounded with a good group of people that can help you along your way. Is that a dangerous message to begin believing?
You know, I think that God wants us to live in community. We're meant to be with one another and to be surrounded by people, by brothers and sisters in Christ. However, there's a term called codependency, and I would define it as an unhealthy dependency on people rather than a healthy dependency on God. And what you described is just that. When we put people in the place of God, what we do is we look for validation in people. We look for people to tell us who we are and what we should do. We look to people for everything. And the reality is our friends and the people around us, that's actually a very heavy weight for them to carry. And it often results in broken relationships, because people cannot carry the weight that God can. And so I would say that is a very dangerous a mentality to have, because it just puts the weight on, too much weight on our friendships and on our relationships. And really, we want to put God in his right place. We want to look to him and ask him who he's called us to be. We want to look to him for validation in our identity in Christ.
Tori Hope Peterson with us. Her book, Breaking the Patterns That Break You. The first step can be difficult, especially if you're overwhelmed by what's happening in your life or the problems you perhaps identify. Where is the first step? What is the key to taking that first step in repair?
I think the first step is usually having people around you who can speak into your life. And when they do speak into your life, you know, I think the first step is when you go to them, maybe asking them the question, what do you see in me that I don't see in myself? Help them open your eyes. And then I would say the second thing is not getting defensive when you hear the answer.
Tori Hope Peterson, a 2018 graduate of Hillsdale College. Her first book, Fostered, and the new book, Breaking the Patterns That Break You, Healing from the Pain of Your Past and Finding Real Hope That Lasts. You can find her on Instagram, on Facebook, also at her website, ToriHopePeterson.com. Tori, thanks so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Oh, thank you for having me.
That will wrap up this edition of the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Our thanks to the late Richard Langworth, also Catherine Austin Fitz, and Tori Hope Peterson. Remember, you can hear new episodes every week on this station. You also can find extended versions of some of our interviews or listen anytime to the podcast. Find it at podcast.hillsdale.edu or wherever you get your audio. Until next week, I'm Scott Bertram, and this has been the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
You're listening to Letter of the Law on Radio Free Hillsdale 101.7 FM. As of October 1st, 1942, according to Kentucky Law Code, anyone who handles a reptile in a religious service can be fined anywhere between $50 and $100. Even with this deterrent in place, snake handling during Pentecostal church services remains as a practice in Kentucky's countrysides. Rattlesnakes tend to be the snake of choice, and as one would imagine, the practice can be dangerous, with multiple deaths having been reported due to these services. Additionally, members of these churches often refuse medical treatment in the instance of a bite for religious reasons. Kentucky is not alone in having these snake-handling churches. The first recording of this practice was in Tennessee, and spread throughout Appalachia and beyond, even reaching Los Angeles, California. Snake-handling churches derive from multiple verses in the Bible, including a literal reading from a passage in the Gospel of Mark, which says, "They shall take up serpents, and if they drink any deadly thing, it shall not hurt them. They shall lay hands on the sick, and they shall recover." Coming out of the Pentecostal movement, which is a form of evangelical Protestantism, participants wish to feel a close connection to God. Members of these churches have claimed that those who have gotten bitten have handled the snake before it was spiritually ready. Services can also include speaking in tongues and other characteristics of Pentecostal churches. This particular law is rarely truly enforced, so much so that there have been several attempts at shows and documentaries following these churches. Reptiles and snakes are legal to own, and police have said in the past that they will not charge anyone unless a child becomes involved. So, next time you're in Kentucky, be wary of rattlesnakes, lest you have a spiritual experience and find yourself having to pay for it. This has been Megan Pidcock on Letter of the Law. If you want to hear more of Letter of the Law or other student shows like this, go to RadioFreeHillsdale.com. Once again, you're listening to Radio Free Hillsdale 101.7 FM.
Hi, I'm Mary, a student at Hillsdale College. Here is President of Hillsdale College, Dr. Larry Arn, on the separation of church and state.
America's founders believed in a separation of church and state, in that the country was not to have an official religion or an official sect. But that did not mean that government was to be hostile to religion, or even indifferent to religion, as many today argue. In fact, America's founding document, the Declaration of Independence, includes both a reference to God as the author of the laws of nature and a confident assertion that human beings are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights. Far from being hostile or indifferent to religion, America's founders understood the theology of the Declaration to be an essential part of the education of citizens.
This Constitution Minute was brought to you by Hillsdale College. To receive a free pocket constitution and declaration, go to constitutionminute.com.
The news from Town Hall is brought to you on KCNR Shasta Reading by Shasta Regional Medical Center. Your life, your health, your choice. Shasta Regional Medical Center.